Hey, do you remember Home Alone? Hello, and welcome to Hey, Do You Remember?, a show where we reminisce about a movie or TV series we grew up with, then take off the rose-tinted glasses to see how it holds up today. I'm Chris.
I'm Donna.
And I'm Carlos.
And today we're revisiting Home Alone. Home Alone is a 1990 comedy written by John Hughes, directed by Chris Columbus, and starring Macaulay Culkin, Joe Pesci, Daniel Stern, Catherine O'Hara, and John Hurd. It's a few days before Christmas, and the McAllister clan is preparing for a vacation to France. Through a series of unfortunate, and let's face it, rather implausible events, they accidentally leave behind 8-year-old Kevin. As the family scrambles to get back to him, Kevin has to contend with two small-time crooks who have their sights set on his lavish home. Donna, what do you remember about Home Alone?
I remember loving it. We went to see it in the theaters. I was delighted immediately and quickly went to quoting lines from it. Yeah, I remember loving it. And a thing that stuck out for years, even when I was like, Home Alone's not cool. I'm an early teenager. I know what's cool, and that's not it.
We
had phases like that.
I like your
was talking that way cool.
I like your internal monologue, Donna.
That was a lot of what went on for some time. But I always remember hearing Carol of the Bells first. The first time I heard it or noticed it was in this movie. Huh. And I loved it so much. So every time I heard it, up until about a few years ago when it started being played every other song, I was out of Home Alone and was happy about it.
Carlos, what about you?
I definitely remember all of the hijinks in the home with like the booby traps and stuff, and being super into like the idea of like setting up my own booby traps in case I ever got attacked by two hoodlums. And I remember just the they really captured, you know, what it was like to be a kid and feel like you were being like not being heard and you know, kind of being neglected by everyone else who kind of had to seem to have their own thing going on. And this was the first movie I ever saw with Joe Pesci.
Yeah, same here.
So I remember Joe Pesci from this, and every time I see Joe Pesci after that, it's like, oh, it's the guy from Home Alone. Like, you know, I'm a graduate of a film program. When I watch like Raging Bull, it's like, oh, it's Robert De Niro and the guy from Home Alone.
Right.
Like, you know, so insane. And well, for me, a lot of the actors that are in this, Catherine O'Hara, like random bit players in this, like even the dad whose name is escaping
John
me
right Hurd.
Now. Thank you, John Hurd. Anytime I see them, it's like, oh, yeah, Home Alone.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, and I've seen Catherine O'Hara in a million things since then.
Oh, man. I don't even know where to begin with this one, because there's no question that this was like one of the biggest films of my childhood. And I don't just mean that it was like a favorite of mine. I mean, this thing was a juggernaut. Like, it came out in November and was in theaters until April or May. Like, it was number one at the box office for 12 weeks in a row. This really was a phenomenon. So I remember that the trailers didn't really do much for me, very strangely. I wasn't dying to see it. And it wasn't until some of my friends, like, they had gone and they were talking about it. And then there was all this buzz about how much money it was making and how hard it was to get in to see it because all the shows were selling out. And then I was like, okay, what's going on here? Because as soon as you tell me, like, yeah, you probably won't get in to see that movie, well, now I have to see it. And so I know this was another one where I had the novelization before I saw the film. There was a book fair at my elementary school. Like, they set it up in the cafeteria, and I popped in there after school one day, like, just to look around, and I saw this. I saw they had one copy left of the Home Alone book. man, I fucking booked it home. Like, I don't know that I've run with this much purpose before or since. Like, there was a girl who got her phone stolen one night right outside our door here, and I chased after this group of kids, like, who had grabbed it. I'm not saying this to sound heroic. Like, I didn't catch them, and not even close. And, like, the point is, even then, even with this girl sobbing that she'd just been mugged, I still don't think I ran as hard as when there was one copy of Home Alone left on this table. but yeah, I lived a few blocks from the school, so I threw open the door. I ran up to, you know, grab a five spot that my grandma had probably slipped me at some point. And then I ran all the way back praying that it was still there. And what a beautiful, beautiful sight when I returned right where I'd left it, waiting for me. I knew we were going to be so happy together. And so... So I read the book, and, you know, obviously Kevin, Marv, Harry, they're on the cover, and there's a few pictures inside. But I remember that I pictured a lot of this very differently than, you know, what wound up being on screen. I saw John Candy's name on the poster as we were walking into the theater, and I was like, oh, he must be Uncle Frank. He's going to play Uncle Frank. And obviously that is not the case. And also the book was not that good. Like, so much of what works in the movie is Macaulay Culkin's line delivery and the reaction shots and just the way that things are staged. And so when you just type out the events of the climax, especially, it sounds like a fucking horror movie. Like, he blowtorches his head, he steps on nails. But, like, everyone's just going on and on and on about this and how great it was. And so, you know, there's no way I wasn't going to see it. So my whole family went, and I loved seeing movies like this with my mom because she always laughed the hardest. Like, I distinctly remember sitting next to her during this and the second one and almost being embarrassed by how hard she was cracking up. Ace Ventura also, that first Ace Ventura movie, she took me and a bunch of my friends She was the loudest person in the theater. Like, my friends were laughing more at her than at the movie. And to this day, like, I went home one Christmas and was watching South Park with her, and she was just losing her mind. So I love that, and I always think of that when I see this. And, you know, especially all the stuff with Kevin and his mom, that always gets me. And, so here's the thing. Like, I think maybe more so than any other movie we've watched up to this point, I was Kevin's age when this came out. It was shot here in Illinois. This is so completely of that era. Like, I mean, this felt like my world. And both these Home Alone movies, because let's face it, they stopped at two. There are no more. like, I love the movies themselves, but it's so intertwined with, like my own Christmas memories, and like, man, oh man, does this bring me right back to being 8 years old in Naperville, Illinois, and being a little kid at Christmas time. And the other thing is, I subscribe to Disney Adventures. I know, baller move. And they devoted a lot of articles to Macaulay Culkin because he was pretty much the biggest thing going on at that point, you know, especially in our world, like of an 8 year old.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be Macaulay Culkin. I thought he was so awesome. And I, oh God, I remember we went to a Sox game one night and they won. So there were fireworks when the game was over. And as these fireworks are going off, 8 year old Chris is sitting there not looking at this like, oh, right on, the home team won. But instead, I'm imagining an alternate reality where I too was a child star and best friends with Macaulay Culkin and what this stadium full of people was actually doing.
Oh God.
Was was witnessing a celebration of our friendship. And, and yes. I'm pretending that he's standing right there next to me, and I'm imagining the story that's going to run on the news later that night. Like, you know, Mac and Chris proclaim their friendship with a dazzling fireworks display.
Yeah, it's not a friendship people like that declare.
Oh my God.
You don't usually declare a friendship with a fireworks display.
I don't know. I mean, I did stuff like this all the time. Like, just wait till we get to the Batman episode. Like, I thought this was just part of being a little kid. Like, just having these weird and intense, like imagination fantasies that could like just completely reshape your entire reality. Like I was always losing myself in this sort of stuff, always. And so anyways, what's funny is that I had a VHS copy of Home Alone 2, but not this one. And I, you know, it became a movie that I watched every Christmas. And so I became very familiar with the sequel and had grown to love it so much that in my mind, it was the superior film. And I remember mentioning that to our friend Brian once that, you know, I watch Home Alone 2 every year. And he was like, oh, the second one, that's kind of a strange choice. And I was like, is it? Because isn't that's the better one, though? And then Kristen got me a DVD 2-pack of both of them, you know, like a few years ago. And we watched the first one, and it was like the first time I'd seen it in many, many years. And it was like, holy shit, I was so off the mark. The first one is so clearly and in every conceivable way a much better movie. So, yeah, it's one that has fallen into the yearly rotation for us. And when we decided to look at it for this episode, I was obviously very enthusiastic about it, but also a little worried that, like, am I going to get anything new or valuable out of watching it for the umpteenth time? But let's find out, because we just watched it with fresh eyes. So let's see how Home Alone holds up. We fade in on the ginormous McAllister abode, which is a real house right here in Winnetka, Illinois.
I did write down, sorry, I don't know if this is the right time, but I wrote down to ask you both what it was like to live in Chicago and the Chicagoland area when it came out, because I did not, so it didn't really register as anything to me. It's just some place, you know?
I mean, that's part of, like, what I was saying earlier about this, just this was like the world I was living in. That's part of what was so cool about the film was, even though, you know, I'm in Naperville and this is either filmed in Winnetka or Oak Park or, you know, other parts around the city, mm-hmm. it still felt like, yeah, this is what it looks like here in the winter. These are places I could visit. This all looks like it's, you know, it could be my neighborhood. What I remember is that, so all, like, a lot of the other kids in my elementary school, because we all knew it was shot here, everybody sort of had their claim to fame as far as what their involvement was. Like, oh, my uncle lives in the house that is in the background of this shot. And I remember one girl in class being like, that part where he runs over that bridge and there's a train going by, my grandma is on that train. I was like, no, she's not. Are you fucking nuts? Oh my God.
I've definitely known, like, my friend's dad was the man who gets knocked over by the policeman when he's running, you know, from the grocery yeah. store or whatever. Yeah, things like that.
Yeah.
But for me, growing up in the city, this, I mean, because you had real Chicagoans in the movie with Chicago accents that didn't sound forced.
Yeah.
And there was the CPD, you know, uniforms.
Yes.
And O'Hare Airport is a player in this. And
they've
it
got
just
the
felt
flag
very...
up.
Mm-hmm. It felt very normal. Like, it just like, yeah, this is the world. Finally.
Oh, wow.
None of this make-believe world that, you know, like New York. Like, what is that? It's not even a real place. You know?
That's like, so funny. I bet that was awesome. I thought that watching it just this time because it had no bearing on me of where that was. It was, you know, my region. Winter looked like that at my house too, but. Not,
right.
you know.
Well, so there were a few movies different. Like that, though. There were a few movies like that, in the, like the John Hughes movies of the 80s.
Oh, and yeah.
He produced this. But, like, yeah, they were all shot in Illinois. But there were even, like, Lucas, which isn't, like, a John Hughes movie, but that was, like, Lake Forest. Like, very much the same. Like, it all just kind of felt like, yeah, this is where we grew up. This is what the world looks like where we are.
I thought that was cool. I mean, I bought it all. I just had no frame of reference. Watching it again, I was like, oh, these are really Chicago-y accents. And this is very clearly the Chicago flag is all over this place. And there were so many things that I recognized now that I was like, what did I think about that? I guess nothing.
Chicago
if you guys thought anything about it. Yeah.
Chicago police don't look real good in this movie, I'll tell you that much.
We'll get to that. Oh boy, will we get to that. Yeah. Well, so the story starts with, like, you know, the it's a madhouse. You know, they got two sets of parents, a whole gaggle of kids. Everybody's running around scrambling to get ready for their flight to Paris the following morning. And in the midst of all of that, there's Harry, played by Joe Pesci. And like Carlos, this is the first thing I saw Joe Pesci in. I hope it was anyways, because my mom had no business showing me Goodfellas when I was 8 years old. That's for sure. But speaking of Goodfellas, Robert De Niro was offered this role. And so was John Lovitz. And I can't remember where I read this, but on some website that mentioned this, it said they both passed. One of them probably regrets it more than the other.
That's sad. That's awesome.
So Pesci plays Harry, one of the crooks who's casing the neighborhood, only we don't know he's a crook yet. Well, unless you've seen the trailers, commercials, or the poster, I guess. But
absolutely.
But because he's disguised as a cop, and he's going around pretending to check in on all these well-to-do families to make sure they're all taking the proper security precautions, like with the holiday coming up and whatnot. And meanwhile, we head upstairs to meet Kevin and his parents. Now, Kevin's mom, as we've mentioned, Kate, is played by Catherine O'Hara. And I know Donna and I are both huge, huge fans of hers. Like when we used to work together, there were a lot of Waiting for Guffman quotes being thrown back and forth. So, even with as much as she's done, just like Carlos, like you said, these are the roles I identify these people with. And like, especially, I think, you know, Catherine O'Hara has maybe had a more varied and like versatile career than John Hurd, but that's not a dig on John Hurd. I was not previously aware of this, but according to Chris Columbus, the director of the movie, John Hurd was not a happy camper when they were filming this. Like he thought this was total junk and that it was going to turn out terribly. And, which is funny because, you know, again, to me, this is the role that I most identify him with. Like, it doesn't matter what he pops up in. It's just there's Mr. McAllister. Like when he dies in The Sopranos, I was like, not Peter, you monsters. Come on. He's got kids.
Yeah, I found his role in The Sopranos almost unbelievable because of his role in Home Alone. It's like, no, yeah, he's not totally. a crooked detective. Like, that's no. I don't buy it. No.
Well, so anyway, though, but after the success of the film, he had a change of heart. And I guess when it came time to shoot his first scene on the sequel, you know, they yell action. And before he gives his first line, he just breaks character, turns to the director and apologized for being kind of shitty and admitting that he'd been wrong about the first movie.
He kind of looks like he doesn't want to be there for a lot of the movie.
That's so crazy. Yeah. I was going to say that I didn't get that at all. That like in spite of not, you know, knowing that now, it's so hard to believe because I the parents were always one of the best parts of the movies for me.
I think he has when it's he and Catherine O'Hara by themselves, like on the plane, that like back and forth they have about like forgetting like what it was that they forgot. Uh-huh. I think that's great. I think the stuff around the house, like which might have been, I don't know, the first stuff that they shot, or maybe it was the last stuff, and he didn't think the movie was going to succeed. But he just kind of looks to me, he looks like he's kind of cut off, and like he's not really like attaching to any kind of emotions that a father would feel if, for instance, his brother just called his son a little jerk.
Oh, that always bugged me. That's like my parents would never have let another family member speak to me that way.
Yeah, if I called my niece a little jerk, like with that kind of fervor, my brother would have words for me, you know.
Yeah,
as well he should.
Yeah.
I like to speak harshly to children often. Sometimes I get away with it.
Speaking of children, of course, there's Kevin. And I always forget how tiny he is in this one because, again, for a lot of years, it was the sequel that I kept going back to. So that's sort of how I imagine Kevin McAllister. But, yeah, he's just a teeny tiny little guy in this one. And he's so good. Like, I mean, I think in general that the older Macaulay Culkin got, like the more stilted the acting started to become. But in this, it just seems so natural and effortless. And probably because it was, because he's just being an 8-year-old kid. So,
yeah.
I mean, I remember when we did Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, this movie came up a lot. And Carlos, I remember at one point you were talking about how shitty the kids were in that movie. And, you know, like sort of in contrast to Kevin in Home Alone and how he was so sweet. And you're thinking, why does everybody pick on him? And that was my memory of it, too. But that's one, you know, one of the things I usually forget about Home Alone 1. He's a real shithead. Like, he's a bad kid. And I'm,
but he doesn't start off that way. He starts off just kind of like
no, he does.
Bags and help.
No, he does start off shitty right away, right to his mom immediately, because one of his first lines is when she's like on the phone with someone and she asks him to do something and he's like, "Get off the phone and make me. Why don't you?"
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, I would have beat him.
See, this is why he had to play this part, because some of this dialogue with another kid playing Kevin, you'd never get on board with the character. But I think there's something so playful and pleasant about him that you just laugh at how terribly behaved he is, and then maybe feel kind of bad for laughing. But like, yeah, there are lines like that one that are so surprising and so awful that they make me laugh out loud every time I watch this. And, I think my favorite one is probably when he gets reprimanded later and Kate tells him to go upstairs and he's like, "I am upstairs, dummy." Like, yeah. Who are you?
I was going to say, that was the one that was like, that's not believable. I would have beaten my child if like, my 8-year-old child called me a dummy. It's like, no, that's where this dummy movie gets real dark real fast.
I mean, it really is no small dummy feat that they... You know, they can pull all of this off while still making him likable. Like, some of that has to do with how everyone else treats him and understanding why he would act out. But a lot of that is just Macaulay Culkin himself. And, well, I guess he's the reason the movie exists, because when they were shooting Uncle Buck, John Hughes got the idea for Home Alone while shooting a scene where Macaulay Culkin interrogates a babysitter through a letterbox. And so even though the part was written for him, Columbus, I guess, still, you know, they auditioned like 100 other kids just to make sure that, you know, they had really found the right one. But yeah, so all the other kids are running around and being shitty to him. They mention that he'll have to sleep with Fuller that night. Fuller is played by Macaulay Culkin's real life brother, Kieran, and he's the bedwetter. If he has anything to drink, it's going to be a real slippery night for Kevin. So, and then we see Kevin's older brother, Buzz, talking to Harry Potter about French women. And this talk is like, it's interrupted by the sight of old man Marley salting the sidewalk outside. And old man Marley is Daniel Day-Lewis in his Abraham Lincoln makeup, essentially. That's totally what he looks like. but this is great because every neighborhood had one. An old man Marley, not a Daniel Day-Lewis. We should be so lucky.
God, I wish I had a Daniel Day-Lewis. That'd be awesome.
But yeah, I mean,
did you drink your milkshake?
Did you guys ever have someone you made up urban legends about as kids?
We had older people on our block who we just knew not to play by their house because they were mean, and they probably weren't mean. They probably were like very pleasant people, but
just like,
they just didn't interact with children all that well, maybe.
Or like they preferred you didn't leave their shit in their yard. We had a couple like that. They're like, "Hey, get your shit on my yard," which is a perfectly valid point of view if you're a homeowner who does not have children. I feel like it's valid to be like, "Yo, kids, move your stuff."
Yeah, when we were kids, we used to run in between like the gangways of all of the buildings on our block. So
yeah,
like, even if you had a fence, it was like, "Yeah, we're just going to open the gate and use the gangway. We're playing."
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, wow.
We're precocious. Yeah, we did it. I mean, like, on our block, that's just, like, kind of, there were a lot of kids on our block when I was growing up. So, like, it just kind of happened that way. But there, we knew that there were, like, one or two houses that you just didn't do that to. Like, those were the, like, all the parents would be like, "Don't mess with that house," basically. Probably because they were getting an earful. That's probably what it was. But it probably wasn't because, like, "Because he'll kill you." Like, I don't think it was that.
Well, I mean, you know, the kids in my neighborhood, they, everybody seemed to have a very vivid imagination because, like, there, we had quite a few, like, stories like this. And especially because little kids are really shitty and so judgmental and, like, just the yarns they can then spin together. And, like, I mean, if everyone's stories had been true, then that means I lived near 5 or 6 serial killers and a dozen haunted houses. You know what I mean? It was just, it's ridiculous. The main one I remember, though, and I'm sorry if this winds up upsetting anybody, but it's any of the listeners. It's the truth. This is what happened. It's one summer, my dad was living in this apartment complex in California, and my sister and I would go swimming at the pool there a lot. And there was this sketchy guy that hung around there with this like weird bowl cut and big mustache. And he'd just sit at the pool and watch kids swim. And I mean, that's what we saw. He probably just liked to sit outside and read his paper, but I remember that my sister was convinced that he was up to no good. And so, God. So we started running these tests where one of us would get out of the pool and walk past him and maybe stretch or something. And then the other one would watch to see if he checked us out. Which, in retrospect, great plan. Oh, you like this? God. So, well, speaking of great plans, so I guess, like, you know, at some point, I decided that if he was a pervert who liked looking at kids, he must also just be a giant pervert, period, which was great news for me because I was 12 or 13, and so I, too, had recently become a giant pervert. And so I just assumed that he had some gigantic magic vault full of pornography and was maybe holding on to some Playboys that he wasn't that into anymore, something like that. So, oh my God, this is one of those stories that is going to horrify my parents if they hear this, because there's so much we did as kids that they never knew about. And I know my stepdad in particular gets really, really worked up about some of this stuff when he hears about it now. But so, okay. I'm
already worked up about this story, and I didn't have any hand in raising you. Good Lord.
So I had enough sense to know that if I just went and knocked on his door, he wasn't just going to hand me a stack of dirty magazines. I'm a kid.
Oh, no.
What I did think he might go for is this. So I had some money that my mom had my mom had given me to spend on, like, souvenirs and stuff that summer, you know, first trip to California. And so I took, you know, a $20 bill, and I put it under my dad's doormat. And then I wrote this note that said, I can't believe I'm telling this story. The note said, here's $20. I'd like a stack of Playboys or, you know, whatever else you might have, Penthouse Hustler, not picky. Here's the unit number I'm staying in. If you come in the middle of the night, you'll find this $20 under the doormat. And,
oh,
you know,
Lord.
Take the $20, leave the Playboys, and then I was going to come in and swipe them before anybody else saw. So I put this note in an envelope. I taped it to his door, and that was that. So,
oh my God.
My sister and I shared a room, and it was right next to the front door. Like, you could look out the window and see who was standing there. And so all night, I just keep checking for a stack of porn to magically appear at my front door. And then eventually, I didn't want to, but I couldn't help it. I fell asleep. The next morning, check again. Still nothing. So I go outside. I look under the mat. Surprise, surprise, the $20 is gone.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And so I try to casually ask anyone else if they maybe saw anything at the door that morning. And I distinctly remember my dad very suspiciously asking, are you expecting something? And how dumb am I that I didn't think this special delivery wouldn't send up a red flag for anyone else that stumbled upon it? Like, there's no way my dad or stepmom would have, you know, gone out to get the paper and accidentally picked up 10 Playboys instead. Like, oh, the Chronicle's getting a little racy. Like, that obviously was not going to happen. And then so I start asking, like, if anybody, you know, I'm missing this $20 bill. Has anyone seen this $20? Nope, nothing. So I realized I'd made a mistake and that I probably shouldn't hold my breath waiting for Touchy McMustache to drop off the goods. But all things considered, the story could have ended very differently. So, so that's that. Anyways, Home Alone.
I don't even know what to say to that.
How about that? I know, Lord.
I'm sorry, Mom, if you hear this. I'm fine. I'm okay. Nothing happened. I lived.
You lived a very happy life with that man with the mustache.
We had a great summer together. Swimming and looking at porn and jerking off.
It was the summer of your lives. I had the time of my life.
Oh, the montage is so creepy and like golden colored and like soft focus.
He still lifts you up above him at the end. Dirty Dancing style.
Oh my
God.
Okay, Home Alone, because my mom is really going crazy right now. So the pizza guy shows up, knocks over that statue on the front drive, which is obviously going to turn into a running joke. And now he's standing there with Harry, and they're both waiting for an adult to show up. So everyone starts eating. Kevin asks where his cheese pizza is. Him and Buzz get into a fight about it. Kevin pushes him. The milk gets knocked over. And as Peter is wiping it up, he accidentally picks up Kevin's boarding pass and throws it out with the dirty napkins. Very lucky that it was just that one. And then this is, of course, the big look what you did, you little jerk moment. And God, fuck this fucking guy. Like, this is what I mean about understanding Kevin. Like, aside from Mom, Dad, and Aunt Leslie, these people are pricks.
Yeah.
Just relentless, relentless pricks. Oh, and I forgot to mention earlier that the one cousin is played by one half of Pete and Pete.
Yeah, I recognize that.
Yeah.
Pete.
Yes, the guy. Yes, I couldn't remember the name.
He did play Pete. Yeah. You're right.
So Kate drags Kevin upstairs, briefly stopping to pay the pizza guy and talk to Harry. And now Harry has all the info he needs. And you know, about when they're leaving, and he's gotten a nice look at all the stuff in the house. And the important detail here is that Kevin sees his gold tooth glisten. So that'll come back later. Kevin is banished to the attic even after he complains about Fuller wetting the bed. I mentioned this very briefly on the Harry and the Hendersons episode, but I got peed on at a sleepover when I was maybe 9 or 10. Ooh. This kid had a hamster named Hamsty Jr., and he tried to blame it on him. Like, I woke up covered in piss, and I was like, Anthony, what the hell? And he looks at the hamster, and he's like, Hamsty Jr.? Yeah, right, yeah. The hamster broke out of its cage in the middle of the night and expelled 12 times its body weight in urine. That checks out. Fucking kid. So,
My brother had a friend who... in the middle of the summer, one day, just came by our house. We lived together. Came by our house, hung out, and then fell asleep on my brother's bed. I come home. My brother's like playing video games in the living room. And this kid comes out. I'm like, has he been here the whole time? He's like, yeah, he fell asleep. I didn't know what else to do. He leaves. My brother, like half an hour later, goes into his room, and he wet the bed. He peed all over his bed and never saw that friend again. That was the last time he ever saw him. And this was like not a young kid. This was like eighth grade. So that's why they never saw each other again. It's like they graduated and they went their separate ways. He never heard from or saw that kid again.
Oh my God.
I might cut this story out. But so I remember I was working with Lorelai one day, and she made a comment about like, why do so many of your stories involve peeing? And I had never thought of it before, but I do. I have a lot of stories that I'm going to throw Anthony under the bus for peeing on me at a sleepover. The truth is I have 10 times as many stories about me peeing. And one of them is also I was in eighth grade, and my sister and I were latchkey kids. So we came home from school, and I let the dog out and, you know, through the utility room, and I was standing in there, and my sister was in the kitchen going about her business. And I said like, Hey, what would you do if I just peed on the floor? And she's like, fucking nothing. Don't do that. And I was like, no, seriously, what if I unzip my pants and pee on the floor? And she's like, I don't understand what you're asking me. Don't pee on the floor. And I peed on the floor. I just peed on the floor. And I laughed like a maniac while I did it.
Were you drunk?
And then she didn't laugh. She was grossed out. She went upstairs, cut to me with a bunch of paper towels, cleaning up my own piss. And I was like, yeah, I really don't know where I was going with this. I did not think this through. It's kind of like, oh my gosh, Donna, I just remembered the day at work when I peed into the teacup.
You did.
Or not the teacup, yeah. But a cup of tea. I put a tea bag in a cup, and then I have a wild sweet orange.
Yeah,
wild
it was
sweet
wild
orange
sweet
tea.
Orange. And you were like, I wonder what would happen if I made wild sweet orange with piss. You basically just have a cup of fucking wild sweet orange piss.
And that's what we were left with. And then I walk out with a grande cup of wild sweet orange piss, and I was like, well, guys, I don't know where we go from here. This is the punchline, I guess. I'm sorry.
Oh, and you had to dump it on the sidewalk. And still, when I walk by that sidewalk, I think about that wild, sweet urine.
Yeah.
Ugh,
see, yeah. I have a lot of piss stories.
It's gross.
I have
a lot.
So, but yeah, therapy. So Kevin's... it's so hard to transition out of this. Kevin's locked up in the attic and makes a wish that his family would just disappear. So that night, the wind really picks up, knocks down a tree branch, which lands on a power line, which knocks out the power to the McAllister's house. Clocks reset. They wind up sleeping in. And yeah, so the family is frantically getting ready, and outside, Motormouth Mitch from across the street comes over to check out what's going on. We had a kid like this in my neighborhood. Oh, well, the one who pee-peed on me, actually. And so,
he pee-peed on you?
yeah, that guy.
I was probably that kid. I was probably the one who asked too many questions and talked too much.
I could see that from you, Carlos.
Thanks, Donna.
Well, this kid...
Yeah, the annoying kid in my neighborhood reminded me of you.
Yeah.
No, sorry. No.
Good day, everyone.
Sorry, no. You have interesting things to say.
Well, this...
this was this scene of the movie is the first time I had ever heard the phrase slept in.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because I remember the first time I saw it going, what does that even mean? What does that mean? They slept in.
Do they usually sleep outdoors?
Of course.
What's going
they
on?
Slept in. Like, why? Why would they sleep out? It's cold. I had no idea what that meant. And like, obviously, I figured it out that they overslept. But we always said overslept. You overslept.
Right.
Huh.
Yeah. Or you woke up.
Yeah, because slept in sort of implies like a leisurely, like on purpose, like, oh, finally, yeah. I had a chance to sleep in. Like overslept is like the more immediate, yeah. Holy shit, I had somewhere to be.
They probably went through several versions of this and it was like, we slept too late. No, that doesn't work.
It's too wordy.
The alarm clock died and we woke up later than we should. No, that you can't say that with urgency.
Well, the only reason Motormouth Mitch is there is so that when the oldest cousin does a head count, she mistakes him for Kevin. That's that's his purpose. Now, like a lot of this is pretty far-fetched, but when you consider the series of events that lead to Kevin winding up in New York and the next one, this actually seems fairly reasonable. Like, okay,
absolutely.
I'll go with it. I buy it.
Yeah.
So the family's running through O'Hare Airport, and even now, like every time I'm in this American Airlines terminal, I think of Home Alone and I want to reenact this scene. Like, it doesn't look that different even now.
And you want to sing Run, Run, Rudolph while you do it?
Sure. That won't cause a panic. Some lunatic running through a terminal.
Run, run, Rudolph!
It's okay. I'm Kevin McAllister. Were you not there when we celebrated our friendship? Don't you recognize me?
Watching it this time, I just remember going, they said, like, it's, you know, we have to catch our flight in 45 minutes. And they're like, yeah, we'll make it. I was like, they're 45 minutes away from O'Hare Airport. There's no way they're going to make that flight. That's not going to happen.
Well, it's like, that's also like, don't tell mom the babysitter's dead all over again. I've got a plane to catch in 20 minutes.
It leaves in 15 minutes.
I'm going to start packing.
Oh, man.
I can't imagine living like that. Did we live like that?
No.
I was also thinking when I would fly places, my parents as a child, and everything was, there was no internet, so you would just go to a counter and say, I'd like to go someplace.
Mm-hmm.
is there another airline? And that always seemed so complicated.
It was. That's why they invented the internet.
That, I think the internet might be better in this instance. Although I do not enjoy when I have to check in with the computer.
Oh, see, I kind of like that. It's so easy. I mean, it's kind of stressful to make sure you got it. You do it like right when it becomes available.
Well, I flew very early and alone a few years ago, and I was hadn't flown. I don't fly that often, so I really want to be on point when I'm doing it. And my flight was at like 6 a.m. and so I got to the airport at like 3:30 in the morning. Like, mm-hmm. I'm just overly cautious wow. about things like
no,
that.
No, we do the same thing. I understand.
3:30, I'm totally here. And the people wouldn't talk to me. They just kept pointing at machines. And so I had to go to a machine and check in. I was very tired and just trying to figure it out. And I didn't really understand. And, you know, 17 hours later, when my flight finally was due to leave, they called my boarding group, like, immediately. And I was like, what? I'm usually like, weird. I'm first on the plane. They must be doing something backwards. And I found out, much to my chagrin, that I had accidentally upgraded myself to first class and accrued a charge.
Oh my gosh.
Because of a machine. I felt like such an asshole.
Oh no.
And I had a couple of bottles of tiny complimentary vodka to make up for it.
Sure, complimentary after the...
upset after the, like, $50 charge.
Right.
I was like, what am I doing? How did this happen? And the guy next to me was like, you don't do this very often, huh? I was like, no, can you please hand me my other bottle of vodka?
Oh my gosh.
Jeez. Terrible. That's what happens when I fly. Home alone.
So Kevin wakes up, checks the house. Where is everybody? As he's searching the place, it's the first time we see the scary furnace in the basement, which is such a perfect little kid phobia. Yeah. Kevin checks the garage. Cars are still there, so they couldn't have gone to the airport. He's got a great reaction here where he's like, cars are still here. They didn't go to the airport. He makes this face. It's incredible. And so he thinks his wish came true. He's like, and I love this, that the two separate readings of I made my family disappear. And then like all the flashbacks to them being shitty to him. And then the grin with like, I made my family disappear. Like I always loved that. And so this is the part of the film I brought up the most when we talked about Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, this wish fulfillment stuff, Kevin cutting loose, going crazy, because the majority of the movie is actually about this, like the person he becomes when he's all alone. Like it's all about him acting out, realizing it can't be fun and games all the time, that he has to grow up a little and take care of stuff around the house, doing a total 180 on how he feels about his family. And then like the booby traps are just the last 15 minutes, even though that was the entire trailer. And so part of taking advantage of being alone is breaking into Buzz's room, going through his stuff, finds a Playboy, doesn't even have to proposition a pedophile for it. There's there's firecrackers, a BB gun, and of course, finish the line for me, Buzz, your girlfriend.
Woof.
And now this picture is actually a man. Like the director thought it would be too mean otherwise, so they just dressed up some dude. Yeah.
Oh, you know what?
I always wonder about things like this. We're like,
me too, with casting. How do you put out the casting
to
notice?
Make fun of them? Mm. Yeah, right. It's so hard, especially for like someone who is a child.
Someone that age.
Like, because I mean, if you're like a 50-year-old person, you kind of are, you're good with what you look like, basically, if you're an actor.
Yeah,
you know what you're cast as.
Yeah,
but if you're like 18 and under, like, how do you get cast as horribly ugly person?
That's pretty rough, yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad you answered that question. I was not expecting that when I signed on to record this podcast, and I'm feel fulfilled.
It's a smart way around that very awkward situation, so, yeah. And, Kevin's just having the time of his life. Ice cream for dinner, watching R-rated movies. And speaking of which, Angels with Filthy Souls, we all thought this was a real movie, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I actually went to Google it. I went to Google it while I was watching it this time.
Yeah.
It's like, is that a real thing or not?
I was like, I'm going to get Angels with Filthy Souls when I get Scrooges also.
we convinced Donna there was a sequel to Scrooged called Scrooges, starring John Candy, Jim Belushi, and a young Tracy Morgan.
As Peebo Goodens.
Watch it.
And that the film ended with John Candy riding a reindeer into a tornado.
I was getting suspicious when you said that.
She still looked it up.
Started to think me.
So, well, here's the... I didn't realize until the sequel that these were created by the filmmakers, because the one in the sequel goes a little too far. Like, I mean, there's just no way that could have been real. It's just the same... It's the same exact version of events, but escalated. So that's when I knew, oh, okay, I think these are fake. And then, you know, you start realizing, though, you see those actors appear in other things and you go like, oh, all right. But yeah, for our generation, you know, without the internet, without IMDb, you walk into a video store and you're like, where's that Angels with Filthy Souls? You got that one?
Yeah. What
that would
was
be
it
a
like?
Great, like, emo band.
Angels with Filthy Souls.
Yeah.
Or Confused Video Clerk.
Well,
yeah, confused.
Well, we're the Confused Video Clerks, everyone. You've been great.
Well, there's no video stores left. I'd be very confused, too. What is my job? What the fuck am I doing? Why am I still identifying myself?
They changed their name to the Redbox Technicians.
Yeah. Speaking of Kevin running amok and all this stuff, I don't know if you – did you guys ever take advantage of being home alone, even if it was just for like a night or something? You ever do anything crazy?
Oh, I loved being home alone. I'm an only child, so all of a sudden getting time alone is really normal.
I was going to say,
please tell us how it was.
Pretty regular. But that doesn't mean I didn't like it.
No, it means you were programmed to like it.
Yeah, I like it. But, you know, if your parents weren't home, like, because, you know, they'd check on me, but what if they weren't going to be home to check on me? I would just do what I was doing a little messier, probably. But I liked it. I sure did like
it. Oh, you rebel.
I know.
Oh, gosh.
So it sounded like it was going to be better when I thought about it. I was like, oh, yeah, I love Home Alone. But I didn't do anything.
I used to have Home Alone time every week. My mom worked a job on Saturdays, and my brother had, I think it was like ice skating classes or something like that he was taking at the park. And I didn't. I stayed home, and I watched it. So, like, every day from, like, every Saturday from, like, 8 a.m. till, like, maybe 1-ish, I was home alone. So I can tell you exactly what I did. I watched Saturday morning cartoons into American Gladiators, into reruns of Small Wonder and Mr. Belvedere. And I had a ritual where after the end of the cartoons, I would make myself a bag of microwavable popcorn. I would take a little bit of butter and put it into a dish and microwave that down so that it made it into a liquid. And I would pour it over my microwavable popcorn, which was already flavored with butter. And then I would pour salt on it and put it into a big mixing bowl and sit on the couch and watch American Gladiators.
Nice.
That's my home alone time. But I didn't yell like, Mom, I'm eating popcorn. You better come out and stop me. But I should have.
Yeah, I think it would have tasted better if you had.
It would have. It definitely would have.
So where are we at here? So mom realizes that they left Kevin, and right after that, we get the scene of him riding the sled down the steps, out the door. Okay, the angle of this just does not work. Like, this kid slams into the wall knocks himself unconscious. There's no way he gets out that front door.
And even if he does, oh my God, those steps are cement.
Those cement steps.
Those cement steps.
Crack his head open.
Yeah.
So worried. I never did anything like that when I was home alone. And our steps were made of wood.
that was the setback.
Our steps were made of wood. So naturally, we never did anything like that.
Certainly not. Get a splinter.
We used to take the tops off our hampers and ride those down the steps, but we certainly didn't zoom along like this kid does. But yeah. Well, so that night we see for the first time that Harry is actually a thief. He's with his partner Marv, played by Daniel Stern, who I don't know, maybe might actually be my favorite part of this movie. Like, I really like Marv. I really think he's hysterical. Awesome. And what's awesome about this scene is that as they're watching all the lights on timers coming on, the continuity is really good because you can see the reflections of the lights appearing on the van every time they cut back to Harry and Marv. And then Harry singles out Kevin's house as the main event, the silver tuna, they call it. That's the big one. And so Kevin sees them snooping around, trying to get in through the basement door. He turns on the lights, startles them. They run. He hides under the bed. But no, you guys. He can't be a wimp. He's the man of the house. So he walks outside shouting, I'm not afraid anymore. Did you hear me? And that's until old man Marley steps into the shot. Kevin lets out one of the best screams in a movie filled with great screams and runs right back inside.
I laughed so hard when he just screamed in that man's face.
It's
laughed so hard.
Everyone in this movie is so good at screaming. His mom, him, Marv. They're just so, it's so good. But
he maintains eye contact with old man Marley.
I think that's the trick. That's what makes it really hysterical. Yeah. Well, but now we're getting to the part of the movie that this will never not bother me. We alluded to this earlier, but it's the police station. And so now look, I'll go along with a lot of these contrivances, but this is one I just can't let go of. So Kate calls the police back home and explains what's happened. The phones are still down. So will someone please drive over to check on my son? Okay. I love the dude eating the donut who drops a piece of it onto his phone.
That is pretty,
yes.
But, pretty nice.
Oh my God, does this scene frustrate me. These cops are so disinterested in everything she's saying and act so put out by what is a very real and very serious concern. And then when the officer does go to check on Kevin, he rings the doorbell a few times and then calls it a day. Like he says, and I quote, tell them to count their kids again. And that's it. That's the extent of the Chicago Police Department's involvement. Way to go.
It's almost like if you didn't have a better out, then don't even acknowledge the police as a presence in this movie.
Well, I mean, they do a much better job of explaining why Kevin won't go to in regards to like the crooks that he knows are hanging around. There is an explanation for why he doesn't reach out to the police. So yeah, there had to be a better answer here to why the parents couldn't get through to them or why the police didn't get involved more extensively. It's just, oh man.
Yeah. Cause there's like one cop who's like, you want me to check on your kid?
Right.
It's like, mm-hmm. Yes, that's not a hard thing to believe.
What is your job exactly? Yes, this is what I want you to do.
I just sort of thought, wow, I'm really lucky nothing ever happened to me because I guess we grew up in a really relaxed time that, you know, it's like, yes, if something had happened and my parents were like, something happened, people would probably be like, no, it didn't.
Tell them to count their kids again.
Maybe that's the reaction people had. Wow.
I mean, a lot of these contrivances are very tight. I mean, you have to suspend some disbelief.
Sure.
But like they accidentally threw out his passport, so they didn't notice when his passport was still there. You know, like when they're handing out passports, that makes sense. The power lines go out. Everyone on the block is gone.
Right.
They all left town. Everyone in their family is in Paris with them. Like, all of that is really great and really tight. And the one thing is the cops.
Right. Well, but I think the logic of the events in the reality of the film, like you said, it makes sense. It's tight. This all happens for a reason. It's the fact, I think the disbelief comes in when you take a step back and consider the extraordinary set of circumstances and coincidences that had to fall into place.
Yes.
In order for the setup to work. I think that's where people go like, okay. But it's not like they're trying to pull off anything without an explanation. So, yeah, I do appreciate that.
And even the idea that, like, Kevin never thinks to call Paris because he legitimately thinks he wished his family away.
Because their cars
are still there.
Right.
Like all of this is like they're every little thing that you would come up with as a loophole is like, no, they actually kind of explained it. You have to believe it. You have to be willing to go on the ride. But there is an explanation in this movie, except for the cops are the worst police ever.
Right, right, right. I mean, and that's probably one of the reasons that stands out so much is that their own internal logic with this film is pretty tight. It's pretty sound. And it's just – so that one aspect of it is like – because the rest of the script, it's like – as far-fetched as it might be, I wouldn't call it lazy, you know, like you said, it was obviously a great deal of thought into like, oh, well, why doesn't he just do this? Well, because this, like there is a lot of that.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, but back in Paris, they find out that there are no flights home because everything's booked. It's the holidays. The earliest flight is Friday morning. Again, it's inconvenient for them, but totally believable. So that's, you know, 2 days from now, but then what?
Right. Uh-huh. You mean this movie takes place in the future and the present and the past?
Everyone but Kate goes to stay with Peter's brother, but she stays behind to see if a seat opens up on another flight. And then we get the famous aftershave scene. Now, remind me, does Kevin actually shave in this scene?
No.
Right. No. So, okay. I always thought this didn't make sense because that's not how aftershave works. You can't just like, if you put it on your hands right now and pat it on your face, it wouldn't really feel like anything. You would have to have shaved and cut yourself in order to scream in pain like this. But anyway, but it's the trademark pose for the franchise. I mean, this is him on the poster, obviously, you know, wearing a sweater and not in a towel. But, you know, because if they put that on the poster, a naked kid with two skeezy middle-aged men behind him, that's a different movie.
Scared naked screaming child with two middle-aged men.
It's just funny that that's like the iconic image. That's how you sum up Home Alone visually, is you put your hands on your face and you scream. And it's like, it has nothing to do with the horror of being Home Alone. It's the aftershave burns, so... and then what do we got here? Kevin starts climbing the shelves in Buzz's room to retrieve his tin full of cash, breaks the shelves, and lets Buzz's tarantula loose in the process. Cut to Harry and Marv, who are trashing the Murphy's house across the street. While they're there, Peter calls and leaves a message on their answering machine, sort of explaining what's going on with Kevin and all this other stuff. But now Harry and Marv know that, like, oh, wait, the McAllisters, isn't that house across the street? Yeah, they are in Paris. And so they plan to try again that night. Interesting fact about this scene, the voice greeting on the answering machine is recited by Raja Gosnell. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the last name right. Ra's al Ghul. Donna, can you give us a taste of what that voice message sounded like?
I think you're wonderful. Leave me a message and I'll get back to you.
Is he on Quaaludes?
So frequently. Shame.
So frequently.
Shame. Always with the ludes. Bane, we like you for you.
the guy leaving the voice on the answering machine, Raja Gosnell, he was the editor of this film. He directed the Scooby-Doo movies. It says that he went on to direct Home Alone 3, but that can't be because there is no Home Alone 3.
Home Alone 3 and Michael Jordan on the Washington Wizards never happened.
I don't even know what you're talking about. That sounds like nonsense.
Exactly.
I don't think that's real team. No.
No, but quite honestly, I mean, I don't know if our listeners, if all of them realize this, there are five Home Alone movies. There is, obviously, I think most people remember Home Alone 3, which was with a different kid. Home Alone 4, they recast the role of Kevin McAllister. They recast all the roles, Mom, Dad, Buzz, Kevin, they're all new actors. French Stewart from 30 Rock from the Sun plays Marv, who is for some reason dressed like Harry in the movie. Like they couldn't even remember their own fucking continuity. and then Home Alone 5 just came out. I don't know anything about it other than it's not the Kevin delight. McAllister. It's another new kid. So, Kevin goes shopping for a toothbrush. Oh, and Mamma Mia, Pharaoh, do I love this scene? Because he asks the woman behind the counter if this toothbrush is approved by the American Dental Association. And she says, well, I don't know. So she calls Herb over. Now, the actor who plays Herb, wow. When she asks him if he knows if this toothbrush has been approved, blah, 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 blah. This dude gives her such an intense, angry stare. And he said, he's like, I don't know. Like, easy, fella. It's just a toothbrush. Like, the way he says it is like if she asked him, there was a horrible crash on 355. Isn't that how your wife gets home from work? I don't know. But it's a fucking toothbrush. I go back and watch this scene again. It's like there was not another take of this guy. But
going for
so
the Oscar,
while
man.
Herb is having a conniption, old man Marley walks in, slams his hand down on the counter. Kevin starts to back away to get out of the store, to get away from old man Marley, accidentally stealing the toothbrush in the process. Winds up getting chased by a cop, escapes by sliding across a pond. Yeah, Kevin walks home disgusted with himself because he realizes he's a criminal. And like I said earlier, I'm guessing this is why he never attempts to call the cops, you know, once Harry and Marv start poking around. Because, I mean, obviously that doesn't make any sense to us, but it is how a kid would think.
Yeah.
Well, also, though, the idea that when he calls the cops, because, I mean, he sees the robbers before this happens. The idea would be if he called the cops and they're like, where's your family? How's he going to explain that? I wish them away.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I made them disappear. Like, now he's a murderer. Mm-hmm. You know, like, he still believes magic occurred.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, this might be my favorite shot in the film when Harry and Marv, when Kevin's walking home and Harry and Marv almost hit him in the van.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the shot of Kevin in profile as the van stops an inch from his face and his jaw drops and he's just like, ah, it's the craziest fucking like 2 seconds of film. And then he sees Harry's tooth glisten, realizes that, you know, he's seen this guy before. Harry doesn't like the way this kid is looking at him. So they start to follow him. And this is very subtle with the van just like slowly creeping up behind him. It's like when that Looney Tunes character Gossamer, the big monster, is like tiptoeing up behind somebody. That's what's going on here. And the way he manages to get away from them is by hiding in that nativity scene. And he's really lucky there's an extra robe and staff just lying there, apparently.
I always thought that was very smart.
Makes no sense.
But, he knows Harry and Marv are going to take another shot at his house. So this is where he sets up that party scene. And Kristen and I reference this like all the time. Every time we hear Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, yes. Start dancing, yes. And moving like these mannequins, wave to the Michael Jordan cutout. And like there, you know, no one would ever fall for this. But like as a kid, you're like, this kid is a flipping genius. Like how does he come up with this stuff? We see Kevin's family watching It's a Wonderful Life in French and in movies. Everyone who lives in France can see the Eiffel Tower from their window. So, of course, that's in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I like when the one cousin, when Pete says that Kevin deserves what happened to him. He says that he was a brat one too many times. And this time he, wait for it, caught it in the butt. I guess he saw my version of the poster.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the pizza delivery guy and like Kevin playing the movie to scare him into leaving the pizza there. I mean, Kevin's okay telling the lady at the grocery store that his mom just gave him the money to go shopping and she's somewhere nearby, blah, 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 blah. Why doesn't he can't do the same for the pizza guy. Like, I promise he'll take your money and not give a shit, kid. Like, it's just open the door, hand him the money. I had to pay the pizza guy countless times when I was a kid. He was never suspicious. I like that this is the last word on an attempted homicide. Like, what does the manager say when the driver gets back to the store? Like, oh, some guy shot at you? Eh, well, you win some, you lose some. Like, I think... Or maybe they do call the police, and as previously established, they're like, what? Someone pulled a gun on you and you want us to go to his house? Ugh.
Tell him to count his pizzas again.
Oh, God. Well, Kate manages to get on a flight after bartering with an elderly couple. She's getting more and more desperate to get back to Kevin, and Kevin is starting to really miss his family. He's like looking at a photo of them and just and begging them to come back. Things are getting a little too real, a little too scary. And, and then the next day is this grocery shopping scene. And you know what? Stuff like this did seem magical to me as a kid. Like, quite honestly, like the first time I bought my own groceries when I was 19 or so felt amazing. It's like it's one of those moments of just like, I am a goddamn man. Now ring up my lucky charms. Kate, meanwhile, is stranded in Scranton. Here's something I had never heard about this scene. So before we meet John Candy and the rest of the polka band, when she's standing there arguing with the ticket clerk, there is a man standing behind her wearing sunglasses. He's got a big beard. There are a number of conspiracy theorists who say that is Elvis Presley. I'm not sure how they came to this conclusion, but...
What kind of internet are you on?
Look it up.
You've got quaaludes now. That is...
I'm not saying... I'm not telling you it's Elvis Presley. I'm saying there are people who think it's Elvis Presley.
That, like, Elvis Presley just came to the studio one day and was like, hey, yo, give me a part. Nobody can recognize me. Well, he's in the background.
I mean, to be fair, they're actually in O'Hare Airport. Maybe he's wandering around, sees they're shooting a movie. I don't know.
I'll just be an extra.
I don't know how they came to this conclusion. I just know that this is a theory, and I definitely did not start the website www.elvisisinhomealone.com. That's someone else.
That is not a thing. No way.
Christopher Flater.
So anyway, Elvis Presley may or may not be there, but John Candy is. John Candy plays Gus Bilinski. He's there with his polka band. They can't catch a flight either, so they're going to get a van and drive to Milwaukee. They offer to drop Kate off in Chicago on the way. This is some Princess Derpy logic, is it not? Let's get in a van with a bunch of strange men.
Go, Princess Derpy, go.
John Candy's got such kind eyes, you know.
That's the thing. She's desperate. He's John Candy. What are you gonna do?
Oh yeah, he's delightful. Hope
and they knew each other from SCTV, right? So
yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
This is a sequel to SCTV?
Yeah.
Yes, this is actually just a
Home Alone is actually a sequel. SCTV.com. Yeah, I had a typo, but so that's what it is now. It's a sequid.
Dot geocities.com.
Yeah.
Well, so Kevin cuts down a Christmas tree, and Harry and Marv are still watching the place, so they see him out there, and they realize that they've been scammed by a kid. And so Harry wants to come back that night. Kevin hears them plotting, and he knows that he has to be ready. And so Kevin goes to church where he sees old man Marley again. And surprise, surprise, he turns out to be not so scary after all. And this is where he tells Kevin, you can say hello when you see me. Well, then fucking stop scowling at this kid like a maniac, Daniel Day Lincoln. Like, fucking tone down the homicidal shit and ugh. But yeah, so Marley is just a nice old man with a sad story about a son he doesn't speak to and a granddaughter that he never gets to see. And my favorite part of this conversation is they go back and forth is like, so Kevin starts to make an analogy to, to something else, one of his toys the basement, about being afraid of the basement. Because Marley is afraid of getting in touch with his son. And Kevin's whole thing is like, yeah, I was really scared in my basement. And then I forced myself to go out down there. And this guy, Marley, he's so curt. It's just, what's your point? I love that part. This old man to a little kid. The fuck you getting at? And, well, the other thing about Marley is he wasn't in John Hughes's original version of the script. It was a lot of, like, you know, the Three Stooges hijinks sort of stuff. And I guess the, Chris Columbus said that he wanted to balance out all that stuff with more heart, you know, just have some more heart to balance out the hijinks. And I think that was a good scene, or a good decision rather. Like, that's, I, even though Marley is only in what, three scenes, it's for me, it was one of the most memorable parts of the story when I was a kid, for sure.
Oh yeah. I really like him. And it talks a lot. I think that him coming in and having the problems that he has is a great, that happens in families. People start talking to each other, and it's a great way to deal with it as from a child's point of view. Is like, maybe you should talk to him.
Right.
You should try, you know, but that was an issue that I felt I didn't see so much. So I thought it was great. I loved, and the like threat of him is great, and he saves him.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Bad guys. He's like, yeah, looking out for him, which is
because
great.
He is a serial killer.
Right, yeah, that's the secret.
Save him for myself.
He turns them into mummies. The mummies. The I like the role reversal in the church scene too, where it's sort of like you need. It's like, well, Marley kind of turns into the little kid, and Kevin's the wise sage giving him advice. But it's almost like you need just the simple perspective of a kid who doesn't complicate things that are actually pretty simple. And so that part of it was always, I always thought was really cool. And of course, the nice lesson about, like, well, hey, before we go making judgments about people too quickly, you know, maybe there's more here than what you're seeing. So yeah, all that stuff is really good. When Kevin leaves the church, this is my favorite music cue in the entire film. You know, he runs out all determined, and the other great part about this piece of music is that it's timed to all of the lights going on in the neighborhood as Kevin runs past them. And
this is Carol of the Bells, isn't it?
I think that's what starts, and then it turns into the really driving, like, dun da 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 dun 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 da 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 da. And he does incorporate parts of Carol of the Bells in it, actually. But
yeah,
it's an awesome piece of music. And like, when Kevin gets home and, like, he's like, oh, this is my house. I have to defend it. Man, I got goosebumps. I was like, yeah, you fucking do. Let's do this. Let's build some traps, Kevin. And so last year, like, Kristen was going crazy trying to remember what he named his battle plan in this one. Because in the second one, it's Operation Ho Ho Ho. And we thought it was like Operation blank whatever in this one, that it was something else. So when he unrolls it and you see that it's just labeled battle plan, I got really excited because here's our answer. And she was in the kitchen, so I just called out to her, it's just battle plan in the first Home Alone. There is no operation. And I just get this long blank stare. It's like, that's what she always does when she doesn't understand, like, a reference I make or a question, like, that she doesn't know the answer to. She just stares at me with these, like, dead eyes. It's like, oh, sorry.
That's awesome. It's battle plan.
This is the map of the house that he's, like, drawn out.
And he, and he actually drew it. I think Macaulay Culkin actually drew this.
Well, that's awesome. Like, as a kid, this is something that I definitely, like, when I said, like, I you know, had, like, the idea that I should fortify my house with booby traps, I definitely just meant I want to draw a map of my house. Like, that's pretty much what I really just, I want to draw an overhead view of my house, and I'll pretend I'm putting things here or there. Like, oh, I'll put my Legos here. That'll hurt. and that was pretty much it.
Yeah, but, well, so Kevin sets up these booby traps, and this is now, I mean, this is the signature part of the film. And, like, so just we can run through all these really, really quick here, because so we get, like, a BB to the nuts, ice on the steps, an iron to the face. Oh, when he heats up the doorknob, I always liked that Harry gets the M burned into his hand, but watching it this time made me think of the Scarlet Letter, like, oh, I guess I know what the M on your palm stands for. What else have we got here? There's the tar on the basement steps, followed by the nail that Marv steps on. Apparently, Daniel Stern was wearing rubber feet for all of these barefoot scenes.
Good.
Harry's head is lit on fire by a blowtorch. There's glass ornaments, which I guess were actually made of candy. Those are laid out under the window, so Marv steps on those. Got micro machines by the stairs that they trip on, paint buckets that come flying out of nowhere as they try to get upstairs, tripwire by the entrance to the attic. And during all this carnage, Kevin calls the cops. He pretends to be Mr. Murphy from across the street, says, my house is being robbed. Send the police. And Marv grabs Kevin as he runs past to try and get up to the attic. And Kevin puts Buzz's tarantula on his face. One of the legs goes in his mouth, you guys. It goes in his mouth. So now Daniel Stern said they only...
That scream that he lets out is probably my favorite scream.
Well, that's what I was just about to say. There's a series of screams here. And the thing is, he said, you've got one take to do this. You can put that spider on my face one time. But he just opens his mouth. He doesn't actually scream. They dubbed the screams in later because... If they'd done it on set, it would have scared the tarantula.
Oh, shit.
Where are we at here? So Kevin swings to the safety of his treehouse. The weird thing about this moment, I had a friend who was obsessed with the fact that when Kevin lands in there, he kicks out a few pieces of wood, like on the back of the treehouse, because he flies in there so quickly. My friend... kept rewinding this and like pointing this out. It was just like he was just so flabbergasted by like, do you see this? It's the wood from the treehouse. He's kicking the wood. And I'm sitting there like, what are you showing me? What is this? I did not and still don't understand what the BFD was with this moment, but yeah, he was real worked up about it. So Harry and Marv climb out onto the rope that Kevin used. Kevin, of course, cuts it. They slam into the house, and I'm wondering why they didn't just climb out onto that tree that was right there and just climb right down to safety. But three moons.
Yeah.
But you know what? This whole section of the traps and all that, all of this still makes me laugh in the same way that in the way that the Three Stooges makes me laugh, which is clearly what I think they were going for here. I laughed out loud at like almost all of these. And there's a fun simplicity to the traps in this movie because the ones in part two have all these layers to them. Like they're designed to look like one thing, but they're really something else. And Kevin guesses how Harry and Marv are going to interact with them. And he like subverts their expectations so that things play out differently than what they think they're getting into. And it's very elaborate. And you can see how Kevin later turns into Jigsaw from the Saw movies. Donna, did you know that there's a theory like that Jigsaw from the Saw movies is grown up Kevin McAllister?
No way.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And Elvis?
I've never seen them at all.
God damn it, Carlos. I thought you were going to know I was putting Donna on and you were going to help me with it, but I did not expect you to be both of you.
Well, if you wouldn't have baited us with the earlier Elvis is in the movie idea, which is legitimate, I would have believed you. I would have
Elvis is in homealone.com.
Exactly.
Oh God. All right. Well, but yeah, so Kevin runs to the Murphys. Harry and Marv grab him. Old Man Marley shows up and bops him on the noggin with his shovel. Cops show up thanks to Marv's signature of leaving the faucets running and flooding all of these houses. They now know every home that these two have hit. So then it's Christmas morning. Kevin runs downstairs hoping Santa came through with his request. But alas, he is still alone. Fade out. The end. So, final thoughts. Mom comes home. The entire family's right behind her because they took the flight. She didn't. that she didn't want to wait for on whatever Friday morning. Even Buzz and the shitty cousins respect Kevin for keeping everything together while they were gone. Dad finds Harry's gold tooth on the floor. I remember this being the very last scene, like in the novelization, that like Marley reuniting with his son and his family happened first. There was no Buzz yelling at Kevin for destroying his room, that the last line in the book was, "Honey, what's this?" But yeah, anyway, that's Home Alone for reals. Final thoughts on the film, Donna?
I wondered if you guys had crushes on Macaulay Culkin, but I guess you already answered that, Chris.
My first man crush, Macaulay Culkin. Maybe.
I think this is such a nice movie. It's so much fun, and the performances are really outstanding. He was really something, and it's hard because we, you know, kind of overdo it with our child actors here in America, and it gets kind of gross and uncomfortable most of the time. But this kid, there was a reason we liked him so much, and this is it. Mm-hmm. He is spot on. He's lip syncing, and he's running amok, and he's adorable and such a kid. And he was like 17 years old when he made this movie. Like, he's freakishly small and older than he should be.
He's not 17.
Well, he was like 11. He was like 11. He was supposed to be 8, but he was like 11.
17?
Yeah. He was 45 years old.
Oh. When
he played the part. I don't know if you guys heard that. I'm on a lot of blogs, so that's true. But I think you should watch Home Alone probably close to every Christmas, mm-hmm. if you don't already. It is something I didn't watch for a long time, and when I dusted it off again, pulled out the old VHS player and special tape rewinder, I was thrilled at rewatching this. Home Alone is awesome.
Carlos, what about you?
Real quick before I go, do you guys both always call them VHS players? Because they were called VCRs back in the day.
Holy shit.
You've both referred to them... exclusively as VHS players today. And at my job, at my other job where I work, the people there say that they have VHSs and they bought a VHS player. I'm like, it's called a VCR.
It's a VCR. That's
what they were called.
Yeah. I thought I said VCR a couple of times, but you're right. You're right. That is definitively, there was a name.
Okay.
Did you have one of the magic cassette plays?
Was I the only
plays?
One calling it a VCR? Did I have like some kind of lesser technology than what you guys had?
Oh, VHS player.
It was my VHS.
The VHS
player.
Rewinder.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Okay, so anyways, back to Home Alone.
Got us.
So I love most of this movie. Like it was so enjoyable. And, but as I got older, as I've gotten older, the last part when he's setting all the booby traps, mm-hmm. is my least favorite part of this movie. But it's not only the tone shift, because, like, yes, it goes from being this, like, kind of great, you know, movie about a kid, you know, living alone or whatever, to being, like, cartoon violence. But for me, the violence was really hard to watch. Like, he's killing them. They're dying. Yeah. That's what's happening. Like he burns a man's scalp. He burns a man's hand. Like that alone.
His face too.
Yeah, exactly. That alone would have left that man with like some infection, and he would have.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. They would have
had broken, like shattered pelvises and feet. One of them could have caught tetanus. Like idea. I know that it sounds stupid, but as I was watching it, I was just going, "This is like that's not funny." Like it didn't make me laugh. And but the rest of the movie, which maybe as a kid I probably thought the rest of the movie was less enjoyable than the booby traps, but like now as an adult, I think that like once they get to the booby traps, and I understand that it's kind of the only natural ending for the movie, you know, because it's been building up to this showdown, he can't just call the cops. Like that would be a horrible ending to this movie. But like the rest of the movie, I love so much, and then it just shifts, and I'm like, if it wasn't for the John Williams score that kind of pushes you into that moment, I would really hate the ending of this. Like it would be unwatchable. But like you're kind of thrust into it because it's so exciting. You know, the music's so exciting. You're like, okay, yeah, defend your house. But then you see him defend it, and it's like, ooh, okay, you are maybe a crazy person.
It is that. So that's the homicidal part of it that I think is a little strange, because I did laugh still at a lot of it. Like I meant, again, I think that when you look at it as something like the Three Stooges is also incredibly violent, like Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner and all that, like they're going for sort of a heightened thing here. But what makes it jarring is that the rest of the movie, while implausible, we're still on Earth. Like it's still like,
right.
There's some boundaries to all of this. And then it just goes off the rails for this third act. I see what you're saying. For me, the most disturbing part of it is not the execution of the traps, because it's handled in like a really cartoony manner. There's no blood or any of that. It's cartoon violence. It's the fact that an 8-year-old planned this. Like an 8-year-old schemed to light a dude's head on fire. Like that's the part that's kind of like, whoa, what the fuck? What happened to like lovable, clever Kevin McAllister? This is some Jigsaw shit. But I mean, well, the thing is, like, I mentioned that the second one, I always felt like the climax didn't feel as satisfying. And part of what I was relieved by when we watched this time is that I do think this section of the film, even though this is what was sold to us as being the entire premise, every trailer, it's the kid versus the bad guys. This section of the film is mercifully pretty brief. I mean, it's short. Like I remembered there being more traps. I remember it being more drawn out. And I think that's because, again, I'm so familiar with the second one, where it does go on for twice as long, where the stuff is incredibly violent. And I mean, he just keeps hammering them over and over and over again. Like, I mean, for me, I can sympathize with what you're saying in this film, Carlos. For me, it's more in the second one where I have that reaction, where like watching Marv get hit in the head with a brick 5 times is just kind of like, oh, yeah. God, my head hurts. I can't do any more of this.
I'm dreading, like, if we ever decide to watch part two, that like I'm dreading that sequence, because I know that is more violent than, like, I'm picturing the giant like lead pipe thing that comes down and
smacks him in the face.
He could never have lifted on his own, by the way. But
right. Yeah. Well, none of this really makes sense. I mean, they're both dead after the first trap. There's no reason it goes on this long. But like, but the second one also has the moments where I think they're acknowledging what they're going for by having stuff like after they get smashed by the tool chest, their noses are crooked, they're to the side, and they both just kind of adjust their noses with one crack. It's a cartoon moment. You're not supposed to be like, okay, bones aren't breaking, nobody's bleeding, this is just like, it's Looney Tunes shit. But I do think it plays a little differently as an adult. But what I was thinking about was, so this movie spawned so many ripoffs, you know, anything this successful always does. And none of those were ever that good. Like, not even then, even as a kid, I didn't get into stuff like Blank Check or any of the other attempts to cash in on this stuff. And I've been thinking about what makes this one so different than its imitators, because it's not just that it came first. It's like, I mean, I think there's a lot more to it. For starters, even though John Hughes was sort of churning out some pretty subpar work at this point, I think this was the beginning of a real decline. Like, I don't know if you guys realize that after his best days were behind him, he wrote a lot of bad movies, including Home Alone 3, actually. But but I do think that him and Chris Columbus sort of struck gold here. This is another one where everything just seemed to go right. Like, Macaulay Culkin, you know, I hate to use this term, but there's like an X factor there that a lot of other child actors didn't have. And you know, I, cartoon violence and all that aside, there still is a lot of heart in this. Like, it's impossible not to feel for Kevin and for Kate. It's impossible not to root for them. I feel like even if you were too old for this when it came out, even if you don't think it's a great movie, if you can't enjoy this even a little bit on any level, I suspect you're a real bucket of fuck. And like a lot of it is implausible, especially the climax. And but I think it's a film for kids, and like it's not realistic because that wouldn't be any fun for us. Like, we root for a character who is braver and smarter than we would be in this situation. There's like a real sense of empowerment in that. That's part of the charm. Kevin McAllister doesn't exist in real life, but we wish he did. And I think of all the films that we've looked at so far, this one might be the hardest for me to be objective about. Like, I've talked before about forgiving plot issues if I'm invested in the main character, and there's certainly a lot of that here. I think the film certainly has some shortcomings, but I also think a lot of what they pulled off here is really, really impressive. I mean, there's a reason this pops up on TV every year, you know, at this time of year. This is one that has stood the test of time, and there's a reason for that. And it really makes me nostalgic for my childhood. It makes me miss my family. It gets me in the holiday spirit, even when I'm dreading Christmas, which I was up until I watched this last night. And And a lot of this still makes me laugh. I mean, certainly, Carlos, what you just said, I do think I will look at that final section of the film differently the next time I watch it. But I do think it's genuinely a very funny and very warm film. So I still really, really love Home Alone. Well, before we say farewell, actually, there was one thing I wanted to mention was to all the listeners sending in suggestions for movies that you want us to look at. I've gotten a few emails. Some of you have posted on our Facebook page. We are making note of all that stuff. We're talking about it, and we're adding them to the list. And even if we're not getting to them right away, I promise we hear you. We're listening. We are going to start knocking off some of those in the very near future here. So please keep doing that. We really appreciate it. Thank you for listening. But yeah, please rate and review us on iTunes, subscribe on iTunes, like our Facebook page to find out what we're looking at next and to make other suggestions, share your own feelings and memories about these films, and we'll see you next time.